You're listening to Radio Primavera Sound, proudly presented by Cupra.
Welcome to Line Noise, and it's a real pleasure. I got to speak to an artist whose work I've followed for years and years and years on this week's episode, Mr. Dimitri from Paris, someone I've been trying to interview for years as well. As you will hear in the interview, basically, well, I'm a massive fan of the French Touch. I imagine you would all know that. But the very first album I bought when I moved to Paris in 1997 was Dimitri's Sacré Bleu, which is an album I maintain a great deal of love for. It's an absolute classic French Touch album, not French House, different things, as you will discover. And it was really interesting because we kind of talked about that, and that was like the first thing I said, and he was like, well, you know, that was a joke, basically, that album. And we sort of went into why it was or wasn't a joke, or if some aspects of it were a joke, that kind of thing. We also talked about the art of remixing, referencing his remix of Stetsonic Talking About Jazz, one of my favorite remixes ever. Compass Point, which relates to a recent EP he's done with François Kevorkian, Dimitri's unique style, fashion, getting into production, all of these kind of things. It was just before he played La Paloma in Barcelona. Thanks very much to them for setting it up. Like I said, an absolute pleasure to speak to. I hope you enjoy the interview. And Line Noise comes to you with support of Cupra. Thank you. Can I say what an absolute pleasure it is to speak with you? It's been something I've been wanting to do for a very long while.
You would? So, okay, all right. You're not Spanish, obviously.
No, I'm Scottish.
You're Scottish, all right. Well, you, I can understand you. That's amazing. I can't understand any of my Scottish friends.
But I lived in Paris for a couple of years.
Maybe that's why they treated you badly and made jokes about you being Scottish.
Well, do you know, when I arrived in Paris, 1997, the very first album I bought was Sacré Bleu.
Really? Okay. Yeah, we'll say that's a date that's familiar with me. Okay, nice.
Because for me, it felt so French, you know?
I got
and
you.
So, of the time.
Good. You know, it was a joke. I mean, it was meant to be like a Monty Python kind of joke. Like, that's how people think French are. It was just all cliches. And then a lot of people, including young people like you were in 97, took it on the very first degree. And I was really shocked that it was, for me, it was so obvious it was a joke that no one would, you know, deem that I was serious about this. And then, you know, everybody thought it was so French, which was like, okay, well. I mean, it did help my career, but it was meant to be like, you know, I'm joking about all the cliches, people like Pepe Le Pew or the Monty Python, like having that French accent on the show or whatever. So it's funny you say that to me because, you know, I thought old people and Americans would deem it French, but then if a Scottish young person thinks it's so French, then all right.
But I think the thing was, and obviously it was your record, I'm not...
No, sure, know, sure.
There were some very overtly French elements, which I kind of I thought were.
Yes.
But at the same time, and there was a humour, but at the same time, the music itself was brilliant. I mean,
thank you. I mean, I didn't try to make the music particular French sounding, but it was more like, you know, all the package and putting the Eiffel Tower on it was like the big signature. Okay, we're trying to make this full French, you know, the whole thing was like, it's a fake French thing made by someone who is not. That was like the idea behind it. And and it sort of like became like a very, oh, it's so French everywhere. But that's fine. I mean, I like the music and I'm very 100% proud of it. So, but I was really not expecting that kind of like reaction. So it still makes me like, wow, okay, tell me.
Well, this is one of the things I find so interesting about you, because you were born in Istanbul, right?
Right, yeah.
And I don't know, I suppose I wonder what your relationship is with France. I mean, do you feel like very French? Do you feel kind of...
Yeah, probably. I mean, I was raised in France. I arrived there, I was 3 years old. So being born in Istanbul is more of a technicality than anything else. Both my parents are Greek, so, and they came, they were in their early 20s when they moved to France with me as a newborn. I mean, not newborn, but a toddler, let's say. So I got all my education in the French system, and all my friends were, you know, whoever they were. They were, some were French, some were from other countries, but we were all in the same French system of schooling. And I guess more than French, we could say I'm more Parisian, which the rest of France hate, and Parisian hate just the rest of the world. But yeah, that's how it works.
I think the thing that was interesting for me was because, you know, I grew up in the 80s and 90s. And for a long time, French music wasn't really appreciated. And I was quite a Francophile.
I so agree with you. In its own right, because there was nothing much to be appreciated, to be honest. It was just like a French language, sort of watered down version of, you know, pop music from the rest of the world. I mean, in the 60s, they were taking US songs and putting French words to it, which retrospectively have its own charm. But back then it was just like, you know, just like third grade, low shelf music made for the French people and really just remade more simplistically. So growing up in that environment, I was absolutely not interested in French music, and the rest of the world wasn't either. So I felt I was not so wrong. And yeah, it took like a lot of work. Not really, we weren't even trying to be considered by other people. I mean, personally, and a lot of my friends back then, I'm talking like back then, in early 90s, we were already started making some music one way or the other, DJing, some of us. And we were like, yeah, I mean, we're doomed. Like, French never's gonna interest anyone, especially not the Brits. And we would look up to the UK because so many good genres of music came out of there, and they were always ahead of us in terms of catching on new music. You know, they caught up on house music in the early, in the late 80s. And before that, there were so many other things like reggae, I mean, ska, so many things that came from maybe other places, but where the UK was catalytic in making them what they are now. So we're looking up to the UK as, yeah. And I mean, I've said that many times. We'd go to a record store and our biggest fear was to be spotted as being French, that we know we would get the worst service ever if people know us. Just go back of the line for you guys. So so we were very we had this complex of being like, you know, really not as good as the rest of the world musically.
But this, I guess, sort of this is what I was saying before. This is one of the reasons why I loved your music so much. It was, I know it wasn't entirely serious, but at the same time, it was Dimitri from Paris with an album called Sacré Bleu with all this kind of thing.
No, it's okay. I'll give you that.
I want to sort of go back to start off with a bit of history, if I may. You started DJing really young, right?
I wouldn't say that young compared to most people. I mean, I did have a stint at DJing in a club. When was that? When I was 18, 19, so that must have been early 80s, 82, 83. And I didn't like it at all. Because, I mean, I had this idea of DJing, like the scratch DJs. I went to this show where they had like a grand mix of DST and Fab Five Freddy and Breakers and Graffiti Artists. It was slightly before Malcolm McLaren. So there was this time where hip hop was, you know, coming through into Europe. And there was this notion of DJing as being a creative thing. You could do creative things with records. And it was just an epiphany to me because I thought you could only play a record. You couldn't do much with it. And everyone had records because it was the only medium to listen to music, that and cassettes back then. So having this sudden idea that you could actually manipulate the record and become creative with it was really like an epiphany to me. And I started, you know, looking up to all the American DJs and trying to learn things, but, you know, no internet, no nothing. So very difficult to find information. And more or less, I mean, I I was following up the hip hop thing and wanted to play the music that I liked and started doing Edison stuff. And I put an ad on a trade magazine, like Le Magazine de la Discothèque. And I got two calls and I got hired to replace a guy that was calling in sick. And I realized what DJing was about, to play records that made the crowd happy, not the records that you thought were good. And suddenly I realized that this wasn't the creativity I was looking for. And I went more towards radio, which was more exciting at the time, because like you had in the UK, there was the pirate radio movement. And it was kind of sort of the same thing. There was an early pirate movement, and then very quickly it got legalized. So everybody wanted to do radio, and there was huge demand for DJs, any kind of DJ. You could get a job. So I got like a few stints in small radio stations, and my goal was to make a mix show, because I was getting also those mixtapes from New York from DJs like Tony Humphries or Shep Pettibone, who were mixing tracks together, which was something hardly anyone was doing in France, to my knowledge. And I think England was the same. The English DJs were very much like the French. They would talk on the mic, create a vibe, play a record after the other, but they wouldn't like beat match, and it was very niche. So I was into that very technical thing. And I said, if I have a mix show where I can play the music off air, you know, maybe I could get gigs or whatever. I don't know. And my main sort of like ambition at the time was more to be a remixer than being a DJ. I didn't know that a lot of the remixers that I was looking up to, like Larry Levan or Francois Kay or Shep Pettibone, the names that I was seeing on the records, those guys were actual DJs, because I didn't have the information. I just saw a name on the record. So I wanted to be a remixer. I was already some kind of DJ manipulator, doing edits of cassettes and stuff. So yeah, that was, I think the main thing was to make something with the music that was my own version of it.
So you started with hip hop, basically.
I did. Well, it was more like the early rap. I mean, obviously Rapper's Delight was everywhere off the radio. So because of that, or thanks to that, a lot of labels were releasing other artists. There was a lot of compilations. There was this British compilation on Island Record that's very key to my knowledge, which was called Genius of Rap. And that was featuring other artists and more left field stuff. And the music was a bit more interesting. Then there was also this French label called Celluloid, who released the famous Fab Freddy record at the very end, there's a sonic effect that's been used and scratched on millions of records, most famously on Rocket by Herbie Hancock. So there was this connection between France and hip-hop somehow through a French journalist that was living in New York who brought it back to France. And then Malcolm McLaren did the same thing for the UK, and it, somehow it all converged. And it was interesting musically because it was new. It didn't sound like anything else. It was using new technology. It was the beginning of drum machines. Sampling came a bit later. They were using turntables to create music as well. So everything was like, oh yeah, I want to be sort of part of this. But you know, I wasn't into rapping. Obviously it was mostly black music and I didn't feel like I was part of this. And but I was very interested in, you know, the whole production and just how do they make it, you know. So I did start with that. And hip-hop has a history of being based on classic black music from, you know, soul and R&B, and that was the music I was drawn to. I was very much into Motown and soul music, like Sam and Dave, the classic soul. And that sort of took me to, you know, to house somehow, and from house back to disco.
Because I believe you presented the first house music radio show in France?
As far as I know.
what year are we talking? Like
self-proclaimed. We're talking 87.
Right. 87. Early.
Yeah, I mean, I was very lucky to meet somebody that no one knows and talks about, but he had a show on a very short-lived public radio station. That was before the pirates, that was before FM, and we only had like four radio stations. And one of them was an attempt from the government to make a public service radio geared towards the young people. So instead of playing classical music or talk shows or anything else that was very boring for us kids, they had a selection of really good DJs playing imports, stuff that wasn't available, you know, on the regular shops. And it was just a well of knowledge and discovery for me. So, and one of those DJs there was doing an exact mix shows, and he's the one who introduced me to Tony Humphries and Shep Pettibon, because his brother happened to live in New York and would send him tapes every month. And through that, I got taught the art of the, you know, mixing the New York way of doing things, like very long, drawn out mixes, perfectly in key with, you know, stuff that I had never heard before. So through that, I got into the music thing, and I forgot the lost track of your first question, but I wanted to go back to it, which was why
the first house music show in France.
Right. So this guy wasn't playing house; he was playing dance music. There was no such thing as house music because he was like 85, 86. Mm. And through this guy, whose name is Robert Levi Provencal, it's a shame that not too many people know about him, but he had this show for about three, 4 years. And he told me about something in New York called the New Music Seminar, which was some kind of like gathering, like there is Amsterdam Dance Event nowadays, but it was like a precursor of that. It was a gathering of DJs and dance music producers. And he took me there, and I went to a conference, and it was Robert Clivillis from CNC Music Factory on a panel who said, if you want to get noticed, have your own mix show. Okay, I'm gonna try to have my own mix show. And I came back, I did demos, sent them to radio stations, and I ended up getting a job. And I was playing house, because at the New Music Seminar, it was 86, and the first house records came from Chicago. I remember being at a party which was a DJ International release party. I had no idea what DJ International was, but they had all those great records, and I brought some of them back and started playing them. And outside of me and Robert, no one was ever playing that. So maybe he was the first to have the show, but I guess mine lasted longer, and it ended up being on a bigger radio. That radio I was telling you about, the public radio, ceased broadcasting when the whole like pirate radio got legalized. There was no use for it anymore. So yeah, I ended up being in this very large radio station that was broadcasting all over the country. And yeah, I was probably like the first to do it at that kind of scale.
If you had to choose between hip hop, house and disco, you're on Desert Island, what would it be?
Oh, it would be disco, because disco is the mother of both.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, even hip hop. I mean, there's slow disco that a lot of the hip hop people sampled. And in the early days, it wasn't as segregated as it is today. So it was just dance music. So definitely disco.
And you started off making music for fashion houses, right? Is that?
Not exactly, but I started dabbling in production, but most of all, I did a lot of remixes, because that was my initial goal. And thanks to the house music show, I mean, it wasn't strictly house, but thanks to my mix show, I got noticed, because I was playing a lot of my own edits. So a producer called me like, wouldn't you come to the studio and do a remix for us and blah, blah. So I started doing that, and it worked really, picked up really quickly, because no one else was doing it. And I was getting calls like literally like every week, and several calls a week, to do remixes of a lot of French pop stuff, which wasn't great, but I was so happy to be sitting in a studio and learning the trade. So I started doing that, and that led me to meet a guy that was working at the most exclusive record store in Paris, which was open 7 days a week until 2 a.m. in the morning. You could buy records. I mean, I think it is unique in the world, was unique in the world. It was on the Champs-Élysées. And because of all these features, it was attracting a lot of, like, you know, jet set people. And one of them was Karl Lagerfeld. And Karl Lagerfeld was a big client of this shop, and the buyer of this shop was the special buyer for Carl, and eventually they hooked up, and he ended up making this guy Michel Gobert ended up making music for Carl, and he wasn't very technical, and he needed someone to work with him, and he knew I was more of a technical guy, so he hired me to work with him, and that's how I started, like, with Michel, to work in the fashion industry. But I was totally a behind the scenes guy. And eventually that collaboration with Lagerfeld, who was also designing for Chanel, led Michel to be asked to write music, which he didn't know how to do. He didn't have the, you know, none of the equipment or anything. So he was giving me indications, sometimes bits of dialogue that he would take off films and stuff. And I would just sample bits and bobs and had like total freedom to do whatever I wanted. The only brief was, whatever you do, just make it stylish. So that's the only thing that I had as a brief. And I was making a lot of, like, you know, small modules, like very short, kind of almost like jingles, like 1 to 2 minute length songs that were used like once every year. Mm. And after a few seasons, I had about 20 of them. And that became the base for Sacre Bleu.
I mean, you're a very well-dressed man.
Was that?
You're a very well-dressed man.
Ah, thank you.
And I mean, I think you're known for it. Have music and fashion always gone?
It's just because most DJs are not very well-dressed. That's...
I mean, I feel very underdressed.
Well, you're not a DJ, that's all right.
Well, no. It's warm.
And but, it's summer.
But have music and fashion always gone together for you?
You know... I wasn't very, I mean, I'm not drawn to fashion. I'm interested in the things that I like and I find stylish or elegant. Fashion is more somebody decides that you have to wear this or wear that, or do not wear this anymore because it's like last year's thing or whatever. And that doesn't talk to me. I mean, doesn't speak to me at all. So, I like a certain style. I like kind of like 60s and maybe, you know, early 70s stuff, because I learned my style watching movies. Hmm. I think my style book is the opening of The Thomas Crown Affair. It has everything about me that I like. So, and the first 10 minutes, that's it. You have me there. So that's what I care about. I wasn't expecting, I just saw it. I said, wow, I like the way those men are dressed. I want to look like them. As a kid, really, that's how it happened. And then tried to figure out, okay, what's the peer? What are they wearing? You know, where can I get it? So flea markets and stuff, and so on, so on. So fashion doesn't really interest me. I have no idea who's designing for who and what. Sometimes I see things and say, oh, they're good. So, you know, maybe I noticed Tom Ford, or I noticed Eddie Sliman, or people like that occasionally. But I couldn't give you the name of any designer right now, because just walking by the window, I just don't stop looking at something.
You mentioned remixing a few times. I found that very interesting, that it was remixing that interested you more than like making your own music. Like,
why? Yeah, true. Probably because I never considered myself as a musician. I never learned any instruments. Today, I still cannot play anything, but can play everything with one finger or two. So yeah, it's a very... paradoxical thing. Remixer, it's kind of like being behind the scenes. And I started also DJing because I felt it was a behind the scenes job, because back then the DJ was in the dark corner of the room watching everyone, and I always felt like the cat who likes to sit up very high on the whatever library or whatever, and then watch everything. That's kind of my character. And you know, I can see what's happening, but I don't want people to see me. So I think it's part of this. Remixing is like, you're not the artist. And I had no idea what a producer was. So producing and remixing for me is a bit of the same thing. You just act behind the scenes, and you act as a conductor. I would have loved to be an orchestral conductor. I mean, just retrospectively.
Still time?
Well, yeah, maybe. But that's what I like. You know, you just... put pieces together and they make something nice. You're trying to make something nice with all those pieces.
So your remix of Talking All That Jazz is one of my favorite remixes
okay.
ever. basically. Thank
you. Well, one of mine too, so thank you.
How did it come about?
Well, by the time that thing came up, it was people don't know that most times you don't choose what you remix. People hire you to remix something. Because to remix something, you need to have access to a lot of the original master tapes, which are not publicly available. So in the case of Stetsasonic, it was the owner of Tommy Boy, Tom Silverman, who reached out to me. He's a very interesting person because he came up with so many groundbreaking records, namely Planet Rock by Afrika Bambaataa. And I got connected to him again by the same person, Robert, through his New York connections. And Tom Silverman, the Tommy Boy founder, is also the one who organized a new music seminar where I learned about, you know, doing a mix show could boost my career. So he's always been sort of a guardian angel somewhere. And he came to me because I started to become, you know, a little bit notorious after Sacre Bleu. And I don't know how and why he asked me to remix this, but I said, yeah, I mean, I love the song. I would love to do it. And because it was a song about sampling, I said, you know, why don't I do like a reverse thing where I make original music from the samples? And I knew it was mostly sample a song from Lonnie Liston Smith called Expansions. And I said, why don't I get musicians to replay that? And why don't I make those disco records I rave about and go into the studio and make an actual disco record like 20 years after disco has disappeared from the mainstream? And I'm very proud of it because I put together a band. It was the first time ever I worked with a band. We went to the studio, we recorded everything it was live. And it was a real and a true labor of love. And I wasn't really expecting anything much out of it, because the song wasn't really a hit. It was just one of those, you know, very appreciated hip-hop songs, but I didn't see that as a hit. And it became, you know, quite famous, and thanks to the remix as well. So I'm very proud of that, and it did teach me that it is possible if you put the means to, you know, to make live music. And at the time, everyone was sampling. It was the beginning of French touch and French house, and it was a lot of loops. And I said, no, I don't want anything looped. I want everything to unfold naturally. So that was really my my reaction to the loop thing as well.
I read, I think, that you actually lost money on the remix because you were offered this fee and you got a band in. And
probably, yeah. I mean, I didn't even remember. It was definitely not a money issue. I just wanted to make it happen, yeah.
You mentioned French touch. Like, how did you feel about all that kind of thing?
I mean, how do I feel about it? It's been reduced to, you know, filtered house music, which is what came up most importantly out of the whole movement. But, you know, people like Air tend to be forgotten. I don't know. It was a wide variety of things when it started. And because the Daft Punk were at the head of the biggest successes, they sort of imprinted that sound to the rest of the name, which is, it is what it is. You know, I mean, I was part of the whole sort of like scene of young French producers, you know, getting interest from the UK press and then the rest of the world. After that, everyone moved through his own path and did whatever they wanted. Now there is, just quite recent, like the last year or so, sort of like a comeback or a revival of the French touch sound. And it's only a revival of the, you know, disco filtered sound, which is, you know, it's good for what it is, but it was never really what I was about. I'm an anti-loop person. I hate looping stuff around because I find it very sterile. Sterile?
Sterile, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it sounds good for like 20 seconds and then it sounds really boring. So, yeah, it's not my thing. But, yeah, I mean, people like it. A lot of people got into dance music and house music through that. So I totally respect that. It's part of my history as well. And I don't have anything bad to say about it. So yeah, that's history, really.
I mean, for me, I make a kind of distinction between French Touch, which has yourself and like DJ Cam and Air and things like that, which wasn't house music, you know, like, and French house, which is kind of, you know, was house music. You know, I think there's kind of two different things, and I think often they kind of get a bit mixed up. You know, I think it was wild.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to mix up and retain, you know, the peak of the iceberg, really.
Yeah. So you didn't release another album until Cruising Attitude in 2003.
Yeah.
What was that?
I never thought of making an album in the first place, so that sort of happened, and then there was pressure to do another one. I mean, maybe self-inflicted pressure. And I got a few like scares with samples, which totally put me off sampling again. And so that was also, I mean, the liberty of doing stuff without caring was gone, because I didn't even think anybody would listen to the first album. So I was like, yeah, I can do that. I can do whatever, you know, who cares? No one cares. Now that people actually cared and were watching, it kind of froze me creatively. So that took a much longer time. And then I said, all right, well, we talked about Stated Sonic, and I did that soon after Sacre Bleu, and I was really happy with the experience, and said if I would ever do music again, I would want to do it like this. So I started like writing the stuff with an idea that, you know, musicians will replay it, and they ended up replaying it. So it took a lot of time, a lot of money, and I think when it came out, the world was not expecting that. They were more into whatever French house was doing, and I don't regret it. I did it, and I'm happy that I did it, but it didn't really put me in a mood of doing albums again, you know, because it was just like too much effort and with not much return. I mean, not even people noticing, really. It's not so much the money, it's just, you know, people enjoying it.
And take things to the present day. Early this year, you released the Nassau Excursions with Francois Kevorkian, which is a great EP.
Thank you.
And you're referring to Compass Point Studios,
absolutely.
I assume. Why? What do you love about Compass Point?
Well, there was definitely a sound coming out of that, which was, you know, mostly due to the musicians that were making it. I mean, there are a lot of musical genres that actually originate from one place, one studio, and that studio has the same group of people working in there. It's Motown is like this, Philadelphia is like this, and there isn't a genre, a Nassau genre, but there is definitely a sound that you can hear on Robert Palmer, you can hear on Grace Jones, you can hear it if you know. And with Philly, I mean, I was thinking that people were copying each other because they sounded the same. No, it's just the same guys playing. Different artists, same guys. Different labels, same guys. So, and it's the same thing with Compass Point. It's Sly and Robbie. It's Wally Badaru. It's all those guys playing, the same guys arranging. And you have a lot of different artists from different fields that have this thing in common, and which is binding the sound together. And for a lack of a better word, we call it the Compass Point sound. It's always been a sound that I loved without knowing all those details that I'm telling now. So I think once you understand the links between all those things that you've been loving for ages without being able to join the dots, the moment you join the dots, you kind of want to share this with the rest of the world. And that was our idea of, you know, also France obviously was even part of it, because he did work there, he did record there, and met with pretty much everyone that was involved, including the Chris Blackwell, so the owner of Island, founder of Island. So yeah, I mean, it's just a tribute, homage, I don't know how you call it, but yeah, and it's something that is still going on. We have a lot of music, probably like 6 or 7 other tracks that hopefully we will be able to release. So it's Yeah, it's a nice project. I wasn't expecting the reaction that it got, which is a very positive one. I mean, I wasn't expecting to be negative, but I thought it would be much more niche than what it ended up being. So it's great. When things happen like that, then you manage to touch people and share something that you really like and they get it. I mean, what more can you wish for?
You struck me as being someone who the details count, if you see what I mean. Like, it's important where it was recorded, who it was recorded.
I always say, like, if you show me like a square, I always start to see the four angles before looking at the middle. So yeah, it's annoying for a lot of people.
You've worked with a lot of people. You've collaborated with a lot of people. What's the kind of secret to a good collaboration?
I don't think I've collaborated with much people, and I'm a terrible collaborator because,
really?
Yeah, I mean, that's how I think of myself, because I know exactly what I want, and what I want is not necessarily what the other person wants. And the moment there's something else wanting something different, there's always some kind of like tension.
Sir, you need to tell us something or no?
No, of course. Yeah, all good.
Oops. I don't know if I'm a good collaborator, but I think once you find someone that understands what you're about and he gets all those references and all, he gets the same vibe from the details that you get the vibe from, then I guess we're good to go. But collaborations, I mean, I collaborated with DJ Roca when we did this Cerro Discotique thing, which was my first real collaboration, and with Francois, and remixes and things like that, they're not collaborations. I mean, they hire you, you never see the artist, you do your thing, they say yes, they say no, and that's about it. So I've been involved with a lot of different people, but I wouldn't call that collaborations. They're more like, you know, they hire you to do something and you do your best with what you think they expect and what you would want to express through your work, whether it's a production or a remix.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time. I've really appreciated it. I mean, one thing, maybe this is asking too much, but do you think you'll do another album at some point? I mean, I would love one, but that's
it's me. Today, albums, I don't know if they mean anything. I think with Francois, we have a lot of music that we would be happy to put out as an album. We are discussing this, whether it's a valid idea, you know, in our world of today. I mean, it's something that we cannot decide alone. It's good to have a partner like a record label. I mean, we were very happy with Rush Hour because they believed in the project, and they really, I mean, it's a good case of a label, taking you where you wouldn't have been able to go yourself. And that's a great partnership because they do things that we wouldn't have been able to do. So we discussed with them if they think they can stand putting out an album because they need to back it and be able to do something with it, then we're absolutely into the idea. So it's not like, no, never again, but it has to be to make sense.
Right.
Yeah. So it's possible, but when and how, I honestly have no idea.
We shall see.
I mean, it's music that it's not fitting into any trend. So whether it's today or in 10 years, or maybe it'd be trending in 10 years, who knows? But right now it's not. So there's no urgency into doing the album. We have fun doing the songs. We do much more than we ever thought we would do. At the beginning, it was kind of like, okay, we have one, we have two. And then very quickly, they just like started rolling out. And that's super exciting. And now I'm into the, okay, we have too much music. We need to get it out, you know? But how? That's where we have to be patient and go through the right channels.
But, I mean, you don't look like a person that's worried about trends, you know?
No, I'm not. So that's why I'm saying, like, yeah, it doesn't have to be, you know, but I'm the one who's, like, kind of, like, restless. Okay, I mean, I play it in all my sets, the new music. And then, I mean, the other day somebody recorded a set, said, can we play the set publish it on SoundCloud or whatnot. And I'm talking to Francois, I'm like, it has like six of our unreleased tracks. So that's annoying, you know, what do we do about it? So, you know, I would love to for them to be released so that we can officially, you know, give them a name and people can listen to them and not be like that we're holding the stuff and it becomes a little bit too much to hold. So hopefully there will be something, whether it be like several singles or one album, that's up to the label to decide what is best for the project.
Well, you're going to be DJing in about 25 minutes.
Yep.
I'm really looking forward to it. Barcelona's most beautiful venue, I think. Yes, Le Palom. Yeah, I think it's a venue that really works for...
It does work for me, yes.
Yeah, it's going to be good. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks, I really appreciate it. Right. And, well, here's to the future, I suppose.
You're listening to Radio Primavera Sound, proudly presented by Cupra.